Hey everybody, on this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, as you might have already gotten a hint from last week's tail end of the episode of Whiskey Neat, we are talking about Japanese whiskey and one of the, well, the newest, the most recent that's actually released product from Isla, Kilhoman. I've always been a Kilhoman fan, and I have never been a Japanese whiskey fan. I've never been quite convinced. And my good friend Gary, who was on last week's second half of the episode, came back for another episode. And we wanted to talk about both ends of where whiskey came from, right? So Scotland, you know, Scotch whiskey's been around hundreds of years. Japanese whiskey was really started and really perfected around Scottish whiskey. The whole idea was borrowed from them. Gary actually wrote the book on Japanese whiskey, the Japanese Whiskey Handbook, which you can find on Amazon. You can also find it in Specs here in town if you're Houston listeners. He wrote the definitive guide of 40 Japanese whiskey distilleries and over 100 different whiskeys. So it's absolutely a must-have if you're trying to get into the category. And this episode's important for one particular reason. In last week's episode, I briefly mentioned the idea of approaching a new spirit with an open mind and with resetting your expectations. And that has been my initial dislike for Japanese whiskey. It's a different category. And with any spirit, you have to not only, I mean, you don't have to do this, but you have to find a tie to something you love. For a lot of bourbon drinkers, when they want to get into scotch, I always recommend a bourbon barrel finished scotch that, you know, or sherry bomb that really gives them similar notes. So give them a tie, but then approach the spirit with an open mind. And I approach Kayo, Japanese whiskey, with an open mind today. I actually really enjoyed it. And we discussed the controversies around Japanese fakers. You guys have heard us talk about Texas fakers. There's also a lot of controversy around Japanese fakers that aren't really fakers. It's really just, as long as they're transparent and honest about it, I don't care. So we cover the gamut. And of course, you guys have heard me openly just romanticize about Isla and staying on the island in Scotland and how beautiful it is. And Kilhoman is really killing it. They've been around for 10 years. Actually, they've been around for 2005, 13 years. And we go through kind of like the core range, a couple special releases, and it was absolutely fantastic. So without further ado, please welcome Gary Clark from Clark Liquor Brokerage here in Houston. Cheers. Thanks for coming back a week later.
No problem.
Thanks for coming back a week later.
Yeah, the same clothes.
We have the same. Well, you know, I like to stay consistent.
Exactly.
So we just wrapped up one episode. We're now jumping into our second episode, and now I'm starting to realize your point about taking it slow.
Oh wait, we have to stop. Sorry.
What's that?
I didn't put the book out.
Oh well, you can just put it on. This is a podcast. This is very casual. Yeah. So I said this in the last episode. Gary wrote the book on Japanese whiskey. And I remember getting a rough draft of this baby, slightly misprinted.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the way it works.
So you wrote the book on the definitive book on the massive expanse of all Japanese whiskeys, right? So well, how many distillers are we talking about?
About 40 is what I've got in the book.
40 distillers.
Wait, I'll give you the little history of writing the book. I started out, I was representing EY and Akashi and Chichibu. And
something about that makes me giggle. Chichibu.
Chichibu. I sent them an email, the importer, and I said, hey, man, I need some information about these. And they sent me a map. That was it. It was a map. It had 12 distilleries on it. And I think two or three of those were closed. And I was like, oh, okay. I've always wanted to write a book because there was nothing on the market. So I said, all right, I'll write a book about it. Can't take me more than a couple of months.
Sure.
And then once I started researching it, I found out that, no, there's more than 12 distilleries. Yeah. There's more out there than Suntory, Nika, and Kirin. So it turns out there was quite a bit. And so it took me a year and a half. but I got it done. You know, there came a point where you just have to cut off and say, yeah, I know new things are coming, but at some point you've got to draw a line and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And I'll probably update it next year or something. But because there's going to be a lot of new Japanese whiskeys coming out late next year, early 2020.
Well, what's the guy that does the whiskey handbook here? David
Broom?
No. The guy that's controversial.
Oh, no.
Whiskey Bible.
Yeah, Jim Murray.
Jim Murray. So you're the Japanese Jim Murray.
Oh no.
I'm sorry. You're the ethical Jim Murray.
Yes. Yeah, I got diddly on this.
So I actually like. I would recommend Jim Murray's handbook for introduction with a wealth of knowledge, but take it for a grain of salt because his opinion is clearly sponsored by something.
I have found over the years that a lot of my tasting notes will match his fairly closely as far as what I've picked up. So I think our tastes may be similar.
Sure.
But I'm not going to say that Crown Royal Northern Harvest Rye was the best whiskey in the world at any point in time.
So,
I tasted it recently, and it was a decent whiskey. There was nothing technically wrong with
it. Nothing offensive about it.
Right. But then I tasted Peerless right after that, and it was... It was better.
So, well, there's a saying: just because there's nothing wrong with it
doesn't mean there's anything right with it.
I think we just trademarked that.
Yes.
So, it's not an offensive whiskey. The Canadian Harvest Rye is okay, but it's not. But something won this year that was also pretty controversial.
What was it? It was one of the American
either this year or last year. There was a whiskey that won. There was another offensive one after Harvest Rye.
Yeah, I don't remember. I try not to keep.
But it's laughable is the point.
Right.
So
well,
that being said,
everybody has bills to pay, and I am not one to complain about people paying their bills.
The show gets sponsored, and I accept money all the time.
all of these people pay me.
There's nothing wrong with being sponsored, and there are things that I have talked about because it's fascinating and I want to know about it, but I don't necessarily really endorse it. There are stuff that I've really, really passionately underlined and endorsed, and that's what you should really be paying attention to. But I get it. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing inherently wrong with being sponsored by anybody.
Right.
But it's just the idea of being transparent. Coming back to what you're doing, so you wrote the Japanese whiskey handbook, and it is available. Let's start that off. Where is it available?
You can get it on Amazon.
Sure.
And
how much?
It's $24.99 on Amazon.
Okay.
You can buy it at Specs Downtown. It's like a dollar and change cheaper to buy it at Specs. And if you buy it at Specs, they're all autographed.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
By who?
By me. And I think the Richards over on Kirby has a few of them also.
So how many copies are made?
Well, I order them as needed. Gone through several hundred copies at this point. Not anything fantastic. I sold a couple of them on Amazon last month. I was very excited.
That is exciting. Well, definitely check out the Japanese Whiskey Handbook by Gary Clark. And let's jump into the Japanese whiskey discussion. Now, I know we've got two worlds apart differences here.
Absolutely. And let's talk about Kaiho real quick. You know, it's the Japanese whiskey that I brought.
Sure.
It is Japanese whiskey.
Where would I start so I can start drinking?
Start with the black label.
Okay.
I think that's the 43%, as I recall.
That's correct.
So that's
unchill filtered, Mizunura oak.
No color added. Japanese whiskey, unlike a lot of whiskeys from around the world, does not necessarily have to be distilled in Japan. And that's the dirty secret.
The controversial secret.
Yes. And so what...
And that's the fight that you've been... The uphill battle you've fought several times online.
This is actually distilled in Japan. Let me say that. I've seen the paperwork.
Sure.
And I know where it's distilled, but I am bound by the non-disclosure, so I'm not going to tell you.
Right.
But it is distilled in Japan. I can tell you that much.
Well, from what I understand, the only reason why it's not labeled as such is because they chose to label it as such, and it was out of honor. That they didn't want to – it's not fully both distilled and aged in Japan, so they didn't want to go by that.
It does some aging outside of Japan in that they put it in cask onto ships and ship it to the UK to be bottled. And that's very unusual. And they do that because as Americans, Brits, and Kiwis, the people that owned it, I believe, they're not comfortable with having it bottled in Japan. They feel like they have better control over the packaging and everything by bottling in the UK.
Okay.
Interesting side note, when they sent it in, I have some staves at the house from bourbon barrels and that sort of thing. And so I sent the importer a text and I said, hey, man, can I get a stave from a Mizunara cask? And if you don't know, a bourbon barrel, used bourbon barrel, costs you a couple $100. Used sherry cask will cost about $1,000. A used Mizunara hogshead is $3,000.
Wow.
So the answer was no. So I still don't have one. But these are aged in Japanese Mizunara oak. So it is Japanese spirit aged in the Mizunara oak. If you,
for those who don't know, so bourbon barrel is Quercus alba, American oak, typically. I know that there is no requirement legally that it has to be American oak, but typically speaking, Quercus alba.
Right.
European oak is Quercus robur, and I am showing off right now.
I'm glad you're saying it, not me.
Yeah. So the Japanese, the which has been explained to me. So previously in last week's episode, I mentioned that I've never been convinced to really enjoy the Japanese whiskey category overall. And what has been told to me that it's probably what I don't like is the Mizunara oak, or what I'm not used to, per se.
It's what's most famous about it. But it's also very little of what's used in Japan. Just because it's very expensive to use, it's very hard to get, and
which
the
explains
trees,
the cost behind Japanese
right,
whiskey.
An American white oak tree is a nice straight grain, as a general rule, and because they're farmed. Whereas the Mizunara tree is one of those that's all kind of twisted and has the branches that go out all over the place, and it's really a cool-looking tree, and it has a really cool-looking grain. And most of what it's used for is high-end furniture as veneer in Japan because it looks really cool.
Sure.
But if you need a stick this long out of it with a straight grain, you got a problem. And so there's very little of it that can be used to make staves for casks. The other problem is that Mizunara means water oak, so it has a very high moisture content, but it also tends to leak quite a bit. So when you see the pictures of the Mizunara casks, they're frequently wrapped in plastic to stop them from leaking, you know, around the sides, not on the heads.
I would wonder why they wouldn't use wax instead.
Well, you still want some breathing, and you're going to get some way, but they, you know, it's.
I don't mean encased in wax, but they're it's common in the bourbon industry to use wax to, stopgap or fill in the leaky spots.
I don't know the pictures I saw. It was all wrapped in plastic. Yeah.
So
but they were also on their way to the UK to be bottled, so it was also wrapped in plastic to hold it still on the pallets. But that's going to be an expensive way to ship it as well.
Yeah. So this is Mizunara oak.
Right.
The entire line?
The entire line is mainly. The one you've got in your hand is the 43%. That's the standard bottling. The white label is the cask strength at 53%. So these are the same product, but one has more water added to it than the other.
So real quick, what is the price point on the Kayo standard bottling?
That one's about 60, and the 53% is in the like 70s, I think.
That's actually extremely reasonable.
Right.
And I will tell you that as an unsponsored member, and I'll say whatever I want to this guy, I don't care.
If you don't like it, say so.
No, I actually, that's what I want to say, is that I like this a lot better than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. I told you I've not liked it, the Japanese category overall. I like my core Nika coffee malt, Nika coffee grain. I think this is delicious, and for the $60 range for something that went into an extremely expensive cask and was shipped across the ocean, it's not unreasonable.
It is 100% aged in the Mizunara. It's not a finish. When you get to the peated one, it is a finish. They weren't sure how the Mizunara and the peat were going to work together, so they did that. I believe they did some aging in Madeira casks and then finished in the Mizunara.
So then it seems a little bit unfair that you've got to defend something that actually
is completely what it should be. What I was saying about it doesn't have to be distilled in Japan, it's very common for Japanese companies to own distilleries in other countries.
Sure. Particularly Scotland.
Suntory owns 5 distilleries in Scotland. Nika owns 1, and Takara Shuzo owns 1. if you come to the U.S., Kirin owns a distillery in the U.S., and Takara owns brands. They used to own the old Prentice distillery, which is Buffalo Trace.
Sure.
And when they sold that to Sazerac, Sazerac agreed to continue making the brands that Takara owns, like Blanton's and Ancient Age and those things.
Sure.
But, you know, it's very common for them to own distilleries outside of Japan. And Suntory, of course, owns Beam and Maker's Mark and
right.
big distillery in Canada at Alberta Springs. So all of that product can be taken as new make spirit at high proof, put into huge tankers, and shipped to Japan. It gets to Japan and it gets aged. It gets the water is added to it to bring it down to proof. It goes into casks and it's aged in Japan. The areas that the aging is generally done in Japan, the weather will be more like what you're going to get in Kentucky with hot summers and cold winters, rather than Scotland, where it's kind of cold and rainy and nasty all the time.
To super cold, yeah.
Right. So, you know, you're getting quicker aging. And it's completely legal. It's completely accepted practice in Japan.
It's not faux pas at all.
Yeah. No. And I cannot say definitively that Japanese distillers add Scottish spirit. You know, the big guys are
adding
Scottish spirit.
Right, but you suspect that might be the case.
But let me just say this. You can go buy a bottle of Oban almost anywhere you want to go, in any liquor store. They make less than 900,000 liters a year at Oban. Ben Nevis Distillery, which is owned by Nika, makes 2 million liters a year. And you couldn't find a bottle of that with a map, a seeing eye dog, and a Sherpa guide, okay? Where's that going? They're not making it for fun.
Sure.
They're shipping it to Japan, and it's going into their whiskeys. Suntory makes over 14 million liters a year in Scotland. And yeah, some of that's Laphroaig and Glengarry and Auchintoshan, but let's be honest. Do you think that there's 2 million liters of Auchintoshan being sold as Auchintoshan? Probably not.
No.
So that spirit is getting shipped to Japan. And if you can put that in a bottle, and it's cheaper for you to put that in a bottle than it is to put what you've made in Japan in the bottle, because what you're making in Japan would sell for $120 a bottle versus a bottle of Auchintoshan, which you can pick up for, what, $40?
Yeah,
I mean,
sometimes cheaper.
That's profit. This is a multinational corporation. And I cannot, like I said, I can't say definitively that these Scottish spirits are going into...
But you suspect it's far more common than what people
are... The economics of it say it's almost certain.
Yeah. Well, and I know that we've had Wade on the show. We've talked about transparency. As long as you're transparent, I don't care. My goal as a consumer, which is admittedly my opinion, my priorities, is simply I want to know what I'm getting. I don't want to be
right.
duped in any way. And I want it to taste good. If you are transparent and it tastes
mm-hmm.
good, no complaints.
Well, somebody had, last night on one of the boards had put on, they'd seen Totori blended whiskey showed up at Specs, and they said, oh, this is Matsui Distillery, which is the same people as
Kiryoshi. Is it one of your brands? Or
yes, it is.
Totori?
Yes. And they said, this is Matsui Distillery, same as Kiryoshi, so we suspect this has Scottish spirit in it. And you can go on Matsui's website, and you probably need to speak Japanese, but it says they buy spirit from Scotland.
So they're transparent about
They're transparent about it. They also have stills. And they make some of their own whiskey. But let's be honest, they haven't been doing it for 18 years.
Yeah.
So what's going into the 18-year-old is probably all Scottish spirit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say single malt anywhere on it, so they've probably sourced from a number of distilleries in Scotland. But the aging is not going to give you the same product. If you take Ben Nevis and age it at Fort William in Scotland, and you take Ben Nevis and you ship it as new make spirit to
Japan,
to a aging facility in Japan, they're going to taste different at the end of the day.
So going back to what you just mentioned, it's not a single malt. So there's a phenomenon
mm-hmm.
known as teaspooning.
Yes.
All right. So for those who don't know, explain what teaspooning is.
Well, one of the big companies that does it is William Grant. And what they will do is everybody in Scotland trades casks. It's just common practice.
Full cask or empty cask?
Full casks.
Okay.
So you need... a flavor profile to make your blended whiskey at XYZ company. And you know that the flavor profile from Balvenie, as an example, is exactly what you need to go with these other whiskeys that you've got. So what William Grant would do is they will sell you the casks of Balvenie, but they will take a teaspoon of Glenfiddich or Kinvie or whatever and drop that into the Balvenie. That is no longer a cask or a barrel of single malt.
Even though it largely tastes the same.
Yeah, it tastes exactly the same, but you cannot put the name Balvenie on that cask anymore. And I forget the names. They actually have names for Balvenie that's been teaspooned, and they have names for Glenfiddich that's been
teaspooned. So it's a clue. It's a code.
Right.
So if it's been teaspooned and it has this name on it, you know that
this
is really—
and I don't remember the names, but—
Yeah. There is an actual cheat sheet for those who are in the know that tell you that this is really a Balvenie distillate bottling, but it's they can't call it that because they teaspooned
it. But even if it ended up in an independent bottler, they would not then be able to put the name of the distillery on there because it's not technically that.
And when that's a way to preserve their brand. So it's common in Japanese whiskey as well, correct?
Well, see, the thing in Japan is that they don't trade whiskey. So it's a very different— – a single malt in Japan is really not what you think it is. If you have a distillery in Scotland that has five wash stills and five spirit stills, the five wash stills will all be the same design.
Sure.
The five spirit stills will all be the same design. You take that same deal and go to Japan, you're going to have five different wash stills and five different spirit stills. So even though it's a single malt, that's air quotes for those listening, it is a blend of whatever they wanted it to taste like. So when you taste Yamazaki, it is a taste profile that someone has said, this is what we want it to taste like, and they are blending in different styles made at the same distillery. Well, you will not get that in Scotland. There's variations you can do in Scotland, but they're minor versus having different stills in the same building.
That's incredibly layered.
Yes, it's very complicated, but it means that the Japanese don't have to trade whiskey with one another to get different flavors. But what they do is they sell new make spirit to sake companies because the sake companies need alcohol to go into their baseline futsushu sakis, the base, because they add alcohol to them. So the big guys have basically fixed it so that they own that market, but then once they sell that to the sake company, there's nothing to stop that sake company from putting it in a barrel and aging it.
So with that being said, the moving up to the cask strength, while I'm pouring this, and I'm going to pour you a touch,
okay,
explain to me about how the ocean— – so there—
– The guys that do this have had some experience with Celt cognac, and they understood—
– Say that again?
With Celt cognac.
Okay.
And they understood how shipping things around the world can kind of give—
– a little extra oomph.
Yeah, a little speed at aging.
Jefferson's the same way.
Right. And so Kayo, the word, means ocean. And so it's an ocean journey.
Ocean whiskey.
And they ship it from Japan to— – England to be bottled.
Do they leave it in the barrel?
Yes. It's shipped in the casks.
So it stays in the barrel the whole—
Right, and they're
the
generally Mizunara hogsheads, so they're going to be, what's that? The
500 liters?
No, that's the 250s. 500 is the butt.
Okay. Are you sure it's not larger than 250?
I think it's 250. I don't know. You can look
it up. I feel like it's 300 at minimum, but go ahead. I'm listening.
Because the barrel is 200. The hogshead's the next step up that's 250, I think. But I try not to say barrel when I mean cask in general.
What's the difference?
Well, barrel is a specific size. It's about 200 liters.
But it's an unregulated size.
But
it's general rule of thumb.
If you're talking about Scotland, a barrel is 200 liters. It's a bourbon barrel. So they're not using these weird-sized—
All right, so you win this one. It's 63 gallons, 240 liters.
Okay.
So
give
or
take. And none of them are filled by volume anyway. They're all filled by weight, so it doesn't—
Doesn't matter.
Right.
So what— – how long is the journey between Japan and—
UK? I don't know the time.
And what's the price point on this? It smells fantastic.
It's more in the like the 70s. It might be 83. I forget. It's somewhere in upper 70s, low 80s. I bought a bottle last week, but I forget.
It's got that. Okay, so explain this to me. Okay. How does the distillation work for, whereas we use, Scotland, they use barley.
Right. This is all barley. This is malt whiskey, and it is technically a single malt, even though they don't put that on the label. They, because again, if they put single malt on the label, people would start asking about where.
Sure.
And they don't, you know, they have a non-disclosure.
Right.
But, what the Mizanara is going to give you flavor and aroma-wise is a lot of floral. So when I first got the bottle in, you know, as a sample initially, I took the regular 43% and I popped the cork out and I reached around and grabbed my glass. And when I turned back to get the bottle, I could smell rose petals just from having the bottle open.
Wow.
And, of course, this is in the you know, confines of my office at home.
Sure.
And
that beautiful office with those beautiful shelves.
With the 500 bottles of liquor all over the whiskey, I should say, all over the place.
One of these days when I grow up, I'm going to have a big boy office, and I plan to do the exact same thing. All barley.
So it's all barley.
Really a single malt, but they don't want to put it on there. Really Japanese, but they don't want to put it on there.
It sounds sketchy, and I realize that. But again, I have seen the paperwork.
Sure.
And I can tell you that while it sounds sketchy, it you know the paperwork says it's the real deal. And if you look on the back label, it says Hong Kong, but that's where their offices are.
Sure.
As the new product comes out over the next year, they've moved their offices to Osaka, so all the bottles will start saying Osaka on them.
But it sounds like you're being sketchy by not being sketchy. Like you're trying to avoid the wrong impression, and by avoiding the wrong impression, you're giving the wrong impression.
But
a different wrong impression.
Yeah. They have a new expression that's coming out that is age-stated. It'll be a 7-year-old. These are kind of 5, 6, 7, 8s kind of blended together. But the new expression is called the single, and it is all malt whiskey. It's 7 years old, and it is made in a coffee still.
I'm a huge fan.
And that's all I can say about that.
Is that a hint at Nika?
I don't know. I can't
say anymore.
I can't say
confirm
anything about
or deny.
That.
Can't confirm or deny.
I can tell you that the sell sheet on it says that it's made in a coffee still.
Okay.
And for anybody that doesn't understand that, it's not C-O-F-F-E-E. It's C-O-F-F-E-Y.
That's a great point. Let's talk about that
coffee.
For a minute. Yeah. So the coffee still, or the column still, was named simply after the man who invented it. It has nothing to do with coffee.
No.
So for those of you looking for a whiskey on the shelf and it says coffee, it is not only is it spelled wrong, it's not, has nothing to do with coffee.
No coffee flavors to it.
And I know that plenty of people listening know this.
And in Scotland, that does not qualify as
Scotch.
Whiskey.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that. But in order to be Scotch, it has to be in a pot still.
Right. It has to be malt. To be single malt Scotch, it has to be in a pot still.
Correct. Yeah.
If you look, I got to remember which one it is. I think it's Loch Lomond.
It's, by the way, Winston Edwards, good buddy, Balcones, didn't know that.
Okay.
And I won a bet with him, and I don't remember what the bet was, but the satisfaction I got out of the guy's an icon of whiskey. Like he won the Icon Award for being the best whiskey ambassador, whatever. The satisfaction that I got personally out of proving him wrong.
Sticking it to the
man. Oh, and I love Winston. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. But it felt good.
Well, I think it's Loch Lomond that does an all malt whiskey done in coffee stills, and it is required to be labeled as blended whiskey. So if you're at specs.
Even if it's not a blend.
I've seen it on the shelf, and it says that it's all malt, but it says blended Scotch whiskey on it because that's the requirement if you make it in a column still.
But that's even more deceptive. I mean, it's not their fault. They're being forced to be labeled as such. But they're a single malt. And they're hurting their brand by being called blended. Because you're going to get the average consumer who discredits.
They need to be able to do the same thing that Nika does and say coffee malt.
And just be transparent.
But they're not allowed to do that. That's not in the regulations in Scotland. So.
All right. Moving on.
Okay, so now you go to the peated. So this is basically the same distillate. No, I take that back. This is not the same distillate. This is the peated distillate. And it was aged in Madeira casks and then finished off in the Mizanara.
How old are we talking when you say aged in?
Again, given range. It's going to be 5 to 8.
Okay. Significantly older than most craft bourbons.
Yeah. And
for a lot cheaper than most craft bourbons.
Yes. Well, I can tell you it's not craft distilled. The craft distill, you know, the distilleries in Japan, the big guys, the Miyagi-Kyo, Yoichi, Hakushu, and Yamazaki, these are all 2 to 6 million liters a year that they make. The distilleries like Akashi, Chichibu, and Shinshu, they make 60 to 70,000 liters. Not millions, thousands, tens of thousands. And that's all. So when they say they're craft distilleries, they really are craft distilleries. They're tiny little places. But Japan will be hosting the Olympics in 2020. And so a bunch of distilleries at the time I was writing the book were trying to get open because Japan, like a lot of other countries, requires 3 years of aging. And so you had to be open by 2017 in order to put out a whiskey in 2020.
By 2020.
Right.
So this is actually a higher proof, 3% higher than the original bottle.
Yeah, this one's 46, but I believe. Yeah.
This one as well, very light.
Yeah.
Very light.
It's a Japanese cultural palate to be they're looking for subtlety. They want flavor, but they don't want it to slap them in the face. They don't, you know, even
as opposed to Americans,
even if you try Yoichi,
who want a 34 ounce Big Mac.
Yeah, you try Yoichi, it's peated, but it's not Laphroaig or Ardbeg peated.
It's nuanced.
It's nuanced, right. I mean, you taste the peat there, but it's not, you know, slap you in the face.
Sure.
It's more of the tap on the shoulder. Hey, man, I'm here.
Well, I can tell you right now, knowing that we've got to get to Kilhoman, I wasn't expecting to be that pleased with Kayo. Kayo?
Yeah, Kayo.
Kayo. You're talking the $60 to $70 range for all three expressions?
Well, the peated was closer to $100.
Okay.
Yeah, it is on up there because it was a limited edition. And
sure.
Yeah, you know, it's Japanese and they can.
Yeah, well, and Mizunurigo isn't cheap.
No, it isn't. If we've got a moment, I'll tell my great story of getting to Japanese whiskey. Late 80s, I tasted Yamazaki. I was a bar manager, and I had read in Michael Jackson's.
Here in Houston?
Yeah.
Are they still open?
Nope. No, well, shut down. It was a place called Matthias's.
Okay.
Up on 1960. But I had read Michael Jackson's World Guide to Whiskey again. He had a section about Japanese whiskey, and I was like, Japanese whiskey? These people are crazy. But I found a bottle of Yamazaki, and I bought it for the bar because it didn't cost me anything. What the hell? And got it in there, and I tasted it and went, wow, this is just horrible. But again, I was a Laphroaig kind of guy.
Sure.
So I didn't like it, moved on. About 17 or 18 years later, I was working for a wholesaler, small company. And so I was kind of on the buying end of things.
Right.
And we got some stuff in that was super Nika, and it was something else from Nika. I forget what it was. And we tasted both of those, and me and the sales manager both tasted them and went, nah, we're going to pass on that. This shit's not going to sell. Oops, sorry.
Yeah, you can say shit.
Okay. So this is not going to sell. We were wrong. Well, maybe we were wrong. Maybe we weren't. That was 12 years ago. So, but then the guys from Akashi and Chichibu representing them, and they sent me bottles in. So third time's a charm. Tasted through those and went, no, still don't like them. Still don't care for Japanese whiskey. And I went to the Whiskey Extravaganza tasting, and I'm walking around. And
here in Houston?
Yep, here in Houston.
Okay.
I did all my regular scotches, taste through these things. And I went over and tasted.
How many years ago was this?
4 or 5,
okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
Went over and tasted some Ardbegs, you know, the
can't go wrong.
Corey Vrecken, that kind
of
thing.
You know Dan Crowell?
I don't.
I'd love to get him on the show.
But tasted those, and then I went over to the Jim Beam table.
Kroll.
I was talking to a friend of mine who worked for Beam, and the young lady at the table says, can I get you something? And I said, yeah, I'll have a Maker's Mark. And so she pours it in the glass, and I've got it, and I tasted it, and I stopped mid-sentence and said, this tastes like there's nothing there. And it was like an epiphany for me. I said, you know, it really depends on expectations.
Sure.
And so a few weeks later, I got home. I lined them all up on the table, not tasting anything other than the Japanese, and worked my way through them. And I tell everybody that instead of asking the Japanese whiskey to come to me, I went to the Japanese whiskey.
Sure.
And once I did that, and in the meantime, I'd also taken a sake training class and learned about Japanese preferences and that sort of thing. And so then I was able to go into it and look at it at the Japanese whiskey for what it was. So if you expect it to be Scotch, even though it's made in that general style and general flavor profile, it's not. It's not Scotch.
The very first bottle, I decided to do the same thing with, just mm-hmm. to sit down and commit to drinking it neat, no yep. water, no ice, was Brooklady Rocks.
Okay.
And it was like a mission. I kids were in the back of the house, winding down for the evening. I sat down with the wife, opened up a bottle, poured it, and forced myself to sip slowly mm-hmm. and you know, to spend time with it.
Right.
And it forced my change in expectations.
Yeah. You get to know it. If you just taste it as, I want this to taste like, you know, XYZ.
Sure.
Then it's not going to taste like that. You have to taste everything for what it is.
Right. And openly and objectively approach right. it with an open mind.
I mean, if you go into Octomore and you're expecting it to taste like Glenlivet, it's not going to taste like that.
No, completely different.
So, yeah.
Let's jump into my favorite place in all of the whiskey world. My favorite place in all of Scotland.
Islay.
Islay is my... If God or whomever were to bless me with enough money, I'd buy another home on Islay, and we would go there once a year.
It's not the place you're accidentally going to go to.
It's not. It's a huge endeavor. It's a huge endeavor, and if you've never been, there's such a small world feel that even their electricity's on meters.
Yeah.
You got to like put a prepaid key into the meter, and you've got 3 hours of electricity.
It's only, 30 miles across in any direction, give or take?
You know, believe it or not, that's still pretty massive in terms of an island. But
and single-track roads in a lot of places. So.
Yeah, it's very
especially
tiny.
Going to Kilhoman, it's a single-track road, and you're going over hills going, please let there be nobody coming towards me.
I never made it past Beaumore or Port Ellen.
Ah, okay.
We stayed right there in that little beautiful slice.
Well, you're not going to accidentally go to Kilhoman either.
So, and we're talking on the other side of the horseshoe,
yes,
north of Brooklady?
It's on the west side of Loch Endall. And,
Port Charlotte.
Port Charlotte. Before you get to Brooklady and Port Charlotte, there's a tiny little cutoff road that goes to the right.
Sure.
And a little single track, you know, up and down hills and around corners. And every now and then there'll be a place to pull over to the side so that the truck coming towards you full of Kilhoman can get past you. And even if you actually go to the little I say town of Kilhoman, but I'm really overstating that. It's about four houses and a church that's falling down.
I don't understand how, when you go to these places, how these people have lived there. How did you end up there? I was born here. Where were you born? There's four people in the whole
exactly.
city. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean the big town is Beaumore.
Yeah,
and you know, again, there's not that many, maybe a few thousand there tops.
Smaller than Deer Park for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so Kilhoman started in 2005. The newest distillery in Islay.
Not at this point.
In production.
I think Ardnahoe is actually operating at this point.
Okay, but they're not releasing anything yet.
No. But it was the first distillery built in 124 years, or 127, I forget, one of those. 126.
Over 100 years.
126.
Yeah. Over a century later, yeah.
So, the two previous to that were Bunahavan and Brooklady.
Okay. Well, Brooklady was 1886.
88, I think, or 86, something like
1886.
That. 1886. Yeah.
And you talk about...
they were both built the same year.
Sure. And then Lagavulin, Lefroy, those were all 1815.
Prior to that. Yeah,
1815. Or 1815 and 1816.
So around Christmas 2005, Anthony Wills and his family, he had been in the Scotch business.
Sure.
And I, from what
American?
I understand, no, he's English. But from what I understand, his wife's family had a vacation home on Isla, and they went there every summer.
That's what I'm saying.
And they,
I would buy a vacation home and start a distillery in 10 years.
You know, they ended up opening a distillery there, the first one in over 120 years. And it is a distillery, the way distilleries were built at the time that, you know, in the early to mid 1800s.
Okay.
It is a farm distillery. If you've had the Bricklady that was, I think, Rockside Farm or Rockside,
yeah,
Rock Hill,
doing,
something
yeah.
like that.
Rockside.
That's actually the farm that that Kilhoman owns now.
Okay.
So they bought that farm, which is the farm that they were built on. So they own the farm at this point. And they can do everything from growing the barley to making the whiskey and putting it in the bottle right there on site. Everything is done on site. The one thing that
are they the only one on Isla that's bottling on
I
site?
Believe so. Bricklady may be doing some. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think Lafroig's off-site for sure.
Yeah. But they, the one thing they can't do everything they need, well, they can't grow all the barley they need, so they have to buy in some barley. But the 100% Isla, yeah, that one there, this is barley to bottle on site.
Grain to glass.
Yes.
Yeah.
They also can't do the peating for all the barley that they need. So like every distillery on Isla, they have signed on with Port Ellen to buy peated barley
Four
from
mountains.
Them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they buy the same, I guess, recipe that Ardbeg does at 50 parts per million. And that, you know, so if you go to the Mocker Bay, it'll actually have more peatiness than the 100% Isla will, because they're also not on site. They don't peat as high as what they buy.
So, and this is kind of an aside. Did you, and I could be confusing this, did you rep Smokehead?
Uh-huh.
Do you still rep Smokehead?
Uh-huh.
That's Ardbeg, right? Unofficially? You can't say?
It's certainly unofficially.
Okay. So I'll say it.
It's a young whiskey for what it is, yes. But again.
But it's awesome.
Yes.
The only thing that I have disliked about Smokehead is it's kind of like when you see someone growing up, like your little brother,
mm-hmm.
who's very intelligent, very promising, very ambitious, and he gets a face tattoo. He gets, and you know that he's making a mistake on his presumption. People are going to make presumptions, but Smokehead is a phenomenal whiskey, but it's got that skull on it.
The kitschy package.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
But the tube is fine,
mm-hmm.
and the whiskey is phenomenal. I can't tell you how much I like Smokehead. And especially if you're an Ardbeg fan.
Yeah.
But
hint, nudge, wink, nudge.
But I know that there are people that would avoid it because of the mm-hmm. skull. But it's so good.
It is good.
And as soon as you said same recipe as Ardbeg, it made me think of it. But
right.
Kilhoman is up there in some of my favorite Isla whiskeys. You know, I love Bricklady. Not everything they make, most of mm-hmm. everything they make, I love. I'm a huge Lafroig fan. Ardbeg, Lagavulin, Port Ellen mm-hmm. is like my heart. but the only other distillery on Isla that I am an avid supporter of is Kilhoman. Boonehobbin is respectable for what it is. So is Cool Isla. I've always been fascinated by Port Iskaig, but I haven't tried it yet.
You should. I represent that also.
Okay. Well. I accept free samples on Whiskey Neat, just so you know. I would love to.
I almost brought them with me, but you told me 4 to 6 bottles, and I brought 9, so I felt like maybe I should.
Nah, yeah. You're good.
There'll be another day.
I've always been fascinated by Port Iskaig, and I can't tell you how many times I added them to my shopping cart on Master of Malt before mm-hmm. they were available
right.
here, because they weren't available here 2 years ago.
Right.
And I was like, ugh, no. I kept abandoning mm-hmm. the shopping cart. So I'm happy to have them here. I'm excited to give them a try.
The 110 proof, I will tell you, is an excellent peated whiskey.
Yeah.
It's a little bit lower peating than what you'll get with Ardbeg and that sort of thing. But it's 110 proof, but it doesn't feel or taste it. It's not smooth. It's
yeah.
It's subtle.
I think the term is drinks under proof.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the empty glass smell on that Kaya was fantastic.
Uh-huh.
That all that malted barley just shines right through. All right, let's try this Kilhoman.
Okay. You've had the Mocker Bay before if you want to do it. Mocker
Bay. Yeah. No, we can skip it.
Okay. Yep. So do the 100% eyeliner.
Okay. I've had this as well. I will hand huge that fan. To
you. You can pour since I'm having to reach over.
No worries.
I don't want to pour it all over everything.
I'm going to go light here. I'm very familiar with this release. I'm a huge fan of this release.
Okay.
You can get it widely in Texas. Yes. Specs has got plenty of it.
Yep. And it's not at every Specs store. You know, they pick and choose. And
get a cap here. I'm going to read the side of the bottle here.
Okay.
So I've always noted something in particular about this. It's got a very metallic mineral note.
Okay.
Not in a bad way.
Yeah.
But like a stone. Like, you know, the way that a stone and pestle smells?
Yeah.
That a wet stone.
Okay.
Not a sharpening wet stone, but the way that... Are you familiar with the term petrichor?
No.
So petrichor is the term to define the smell of wet earth after it rains.
Okay.
You know, when you go outside and it's been raining and the cement has like a...
Yeah.
That's what I get in this glass.
So kind of petrichor. Kind of an earthiness.
A very of earthiness. Sorts. Yeah, yeah. It's a positive thing.
Right.
So tell me about it.
Well, they just... One of the things that... And I say just. I was there a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now. And they... As part of buying the farm, they had taken over the barn that was across the driveway from them, and they were converting that into warehouse. Previously, all of their warehousing, or most of their warehousing, is on a hill that overlooks Brooklady. So it's not really on site, but it is on the island, unlike a lot of Isla whiskeys, which will end up being aged on the mainland of Scotland.
Sure.
You know, everybody says, oh, it's got that medicinal because it sits next to the sea. Well, yeah, some of it did, but most of it was aged in the central band in lowland Scotland. And that's just the way it is. But Kilhoman is all aged on the island.
100% Islay.
And
Isla.
The other thing with Kilhoman is that they do not sell whiskey to blenders. So
Do they produce enough to even do that? No. Or is it a matter of choice?
Well, they don't. Their deal is to be a single malt. It's not to be part of a blend. So, you know, this is what they're trying to make.
Sure.
And these days, the one thing they don't have on site is a cooper. So everything they buy in cask and barrel wise comes in whole.
Sure.
And they buy most of their bourbon barrels from Buffalo Trace. Or from Sazerac, I should say. So they're Buffalo Trace barrels. They're probably some 1792 barrels, that kind of thing. But you know, it's all coming barrels from Sazerac.
Right, right, right.
And most of their standard aging will be in bourbon barrels just because that's the standard for everybody at this point. But the one whiskey that I didn't bring today that I probably should have that is the most true to what you would have gotten in the 1800s is the Kilhoman Loch Gorm, because everything is done small scale. It is peated whiskey. When you go back and look at Alfred Barnard's book from 1887, you can open to almost any page, and the distillery he's talking about, he'll tell you that the whiskey is peated. So even whiskeys that today are completely unpeated in the 1800s were all peated because that was the fuel source.
Sure.
That's all they had.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no coal.
And that's the way all of these are done. But also, one of the other things that I thought was hilarious in his book is he was talking about the St. Magdalene Distillery and about how extremely old their whiskeys were. But when you did the math on it, they were 7 and 8 years old. So aged whiskey is a function of poor salesmanship. Somebody screwed up along the way and didn't sell something they were supposed to. And, you know, a year later, somebody went and tasted it and went, wow. That's good.
Well, that's actually something I've talked about with Bernie Lovers is traditionally speaking, we as consumers want, not we as consumers, the average consumer correlates a high aged number to a better whiskey.
Right.
And traditionally speaking, the higher age it is, the longer they couldn't sell it. Right. So this was stuff that was generally speaking. Right. 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 They couldn't sell it. They couldn't move it. Brokers didn't take it, and you are what you're left with is oftentimes, at least in the bourbon world, is an over-oaked mess that has to be cut down to 86 proof in order to taste good.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to mention any particular names, but there's like an oval-shaped 18-year-old bottle that I know of particularly.
It's like chewing on a stick.
Yeah.
And
oak water.
Prior to the early 1900s, there was no requirement for aging any whiskeys. And the Irish had sued – well, it wasn't the Irish technically. I guess it was English bar owners had sued saying that the whiskey made in column stills was not whiskey. And the courts agreed with them. But the whiskey makers were having none of that, and they owned all the lawmakers, shockingly enough. And so they changed the law. But in their changing of the law to allow this column still whiskey to be called whiskey, they also put in a minimum age requirement of 2 years. And when the First World War rolled around, they bumped that up to 3 years because they didn't want everybody rushing out and drinking everything they had. So 3 years to this day is the number.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always understood it to be 3 years and 1 day.
It has to be over 3 years.
Right.
So technically 3 years and a minute qualifies.
Sure.
But nobody wants to take the chance. So, but 3 years.
3 years essentially. And
has to be over 3 years. So,
two more bottles.
Yep.
One more segment. And this is a beast.
Yes. This is the Kilhoman Cask Strength.
Should we do that 56. One next or this one?
This is 54.1.
It's comparable. It's fine.
Yeah. I think we're good.
Again, we've talked about this a bunch of times. If I ever, it's not going to happen, but if I ever do get a number of fans, we need a name for them. But if I ever do get a following, we've talked about this a bunch. Three key indicators of a great product before you ever even taste, before you ever read any reviews.
And these guys meet all the criteria.
Habitually.
No
added color.
No added color. No chill filtering.
No chill filtering. And
minimum of 92 proof.
And in this case, 56.9 or 57%.
Yeah. Coming on 114, we'll call that.
All right.
For sake of argument.
Can I pull this cap off?
Here, let me see.
This cap.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's driving me nuts.
When I do tastings, I leave them on there just so it shows nice.
Let's see here. All right, you want a touch?
Sure,
just a touch. Just a nip?
Yeah. I always love when I'm at one of these whiskey shows and somebody's holding their glass like this for me to pour, and I'm like, just sit that down.
Just sit
that
there. Just set it down. You can talk about the social. It's okay.
No, it's not just that. It's all of them. I did Whiskey Live. I did Whiskeys of the World.
Where's Whiskey Live at?
The Whiskey Live I did was in Alameda outside of San Francisco. Impex does their yearly sales meeting at the same time as Whiskey Live, so we all go.
There.
It's a two-day show.
Sure.
And we work the
table. I'm working on it. I'm working on that idea. I'd love to have a multi-day show here. The biggest problem you have
is
having a hotel within
walking distance. Stumbling distance, you should
say. Stumbling distance.
Yeah, this is at a fairgrounds in Alameda, and it's from noon to 5 on Saturday and like noon to 4 on Sunday. It's brutal.
We actually
but we poured a lot of product, I can tell you that.
This is the first time I'm saying anything publicly, but speaking of big events, next year's event has been set. The date has been set. And tickets will go on sale next month for the 2019 or 4th annual Houston Whiskey Social.
I guess I'll be there.
Did you see the date? The date change?
Yes.
Don't say it aloud.
No. That's okay. I don't remember it. But
It's not in the summer.
No.
And that's going to be
that's a key.
That's a key thing. We also have a couple of massive surprise guests that are going to be pretty great. Those will all be announced shortly. In the meantime, tell me about this while I marvel in its glory,
because
it smells, I can smell it from here.
Well, this is the cask strength. It is, as I recall, it's mainly bourbon aged. This one may have, I don't remember for sure.
It's got a bourbon sweetness to the smell.
There was a green label like this that was also a Sauternes finish, and I don't remember if this is or not, to be honest with you. We go through a lot of expressions, and I represent coming on 100 products, and it's hard for me to remember an expression that came
and went.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know the bourbon cask they use for this?
Uh, most likely it would have been Buffalo Trace. But when I was there, they did have some Beam barrels, and they had some Heaven Hill barrels. But those were from earlier, because we were tasting 10-year-old samples when I was there. And
punch in the throat. I was just thinking it drinks underproof until I swallowed.
Yeah.
And then my entire esophagus became sanitized. This is so honeyed and sweet on the nose.
Oh, yeah. and the peat's there, but it's not the defining factor here.
It's not even the second note I get. Almost all honey up front. And it just coats the mouth. Oh, that is fantastic. What are we looking at range? I actually haven't. It's been a while. Macchiar Bay is sitting at introduction.
50-ish.
Okay. That's very common.
I really don't remember.
Okay.
I remember when I bought this bottle, it was 150 out the door.
Okay. And you don't remember the cash?
This was less. It's 100 and change, but I don't remember exactly. I'm the horrible salesman when it comes to that because I don't keep track of all of them. I sell them in and move on to the next thing.
Sure. Well, and as you mentioned, your office is sitting on 500 bottles.
Right.
So it's hard to I think I've got a pretty good idea. As long as I've revisited a whiskey within the last couple of years, I can give you a definitive opinion on it. But if it's been longer than a year and a half to 2 years, I'm going to have to revisit it.
Probably other than just now tasting this, it's probably been 6 or 8 months since I tasted that, and I've been through. I've got another project that I'm working on, and so I've not been tasting a lot
peaks?
Of Scotch, Irish whiskey.
Yeah.
So
you've got a target set or a new product?
No, it's a new book.
Okay.
I'm working on.
Oh, a book.
I'm working on the.
I think we talked about this actually.
With the Japanese whiskey book, the thing I did different than what the other guys did is there's, in addition to being tasting manuals, they are also more travel guides. It'll tell you what bars to go to and what city and that kind of thing. And I don't care. I just care what the whiskey tasted like. And so I sat down and tasted through 100 different Japanese whiskeys on it.
So you
boiled it down.
And wrote
my tasting notes. So it's a tasting guide. It's not a travel guide.
That's hilarious. You boiled it down to the minimum. I would. So are you taking the same approach with Irish?
Yeah, I am. I'm leaving for Ireland in probably about 6 weeks or so, or 5 weeks when this comes on. I don't know.
This will be but, on in 2 weeks.
Okay, so in December, I will be going to Ireland and going door to door.
Distillery to distillery.
Yes.
How long are you going to be there?
2 weeks for this trip, and then I'll probably do another one in March. I'm just going to do – there's a highway that runs from, I think, Dublin to Limerick across the country.
It's
and
like,
I'm
it's like I-10.
Mainly south of that, although I will go to Great Northern and Cooley while I'm there this time, which is north of it.
Going to hit every Irish distillery?
The plan is, yeah.
Have you been to Athlone?
I haven't been to Ireland except for the one time.
So right in the middle of that big highway that goes coast to coast – is a town called Athlone.
Okay.
And there's a bar there called Sean's Bar. And it is officially the oldest pub in all of Europe. I believe it was 800 AD.
Ah, well, you know.
And so I believe...
They've been hanging out for a while.
Yeah, so they argue...
And the guy in the corner has still been there the whole time.
They've got a Guinness a Guinness Book of World Records plaque in there. They argue back and forth with Dublin's Boar's Head, which I think was 1200 AD, over being the oldest. Boar's Head's always been called Boar's Head.
It's been the longest consecutive.
Sean's Bar wasn't called Sean's Bar in 800 AD.
Because there was no one named Sean at the time.
Yeah.
They were called something else.
So whatever it was. But it's a great stop. I'd stop there.
Cool. Okay.
And if I would make a recommendation, I would only add, if you're going to add something touristy, add the places that carry... Like classic pubs that carry whiskey, you know, like they carry what you're featuring.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do the everything else touristy. It's garbage.
No, it's complete garbage. I'm not a drink in a bar kind of guy. I'm the drink at home kind of guy. So
I'm definitely a touristy bar guy. There's a lot of great places in Houston that I'm a huge fan of. But that being said, I don't go out very often.
Well, you're a busy guy.
Busy day drinking with great book writers and authors.
Now this last one is unfortunately sold out, but I'm hoping the replacement will arrive shortly. This is the Impex Cask Evolution 10-year-old. It is our first 10-year-old Kilhoman in the U.S.
First age stated?
There was another age stated that ended up being about 9 years old. You know, it had the beginning, and a lot of them have had distillation and bottling dates on them.
Sure.
But, you know, if you looked at them, they were 5, 6, 7 years old. And there was one, I guess, a year or two ago that said it was a 7 or something like that. But it didn't say 10 years old on it. I mean, this one, 10-year-old single cask.
Sure.
So, and this is a single.
Cask strength?
Yes.
Single cask, 10 years.
It is 54.1.
You're hitting that fourth note. That fourth green light, an age statement.
Yes, age dated, yes.
In single cask, so you're hitting 5. I mean, you're hitting all the trigger words that would send any nerd into
a
frenzy.
And this one is a single bourbon cask. And the one that will replace it will be a sherry butt.
Okay.
And I have not tasted the sherry yet. I tasted this one at Whiskies of the World because I had to go buy the bottle and haul it around the state as our VIP selection. And this is the bottle, the VIP that I, as soon as the VIP hour was over, I said, put the cork in that. We've got to take it to the next show.
Well, I'm honored to have it here.
But this one was about 150 out the door.
So you said the next one's almost here to replace this.
Right.
Is it going to be an 11-year-old sherry?
No, it'll be a 10-year-old also.
But full matured 10-year-old
sherry. Because we only, with things like this that are single cask and very allocated, we will only get maybe 3 or 4 6-packs for the whole state of Texas.
Wow.
And that's it. And, you know, that when we got their 10th anniversary, they only brought 10 cases to the United States, 10 six-pack cases, so 60 bottles.
Wow.
And we got 2 of those for Texas.
Who got them all?
Specs. They put both cases at the downtown store, and they've been in for, I don't know, as soon as they came in, I went and bought a bottle because I don't get them free on things like that.
Sure.
But I went and bought a bottle and took it home, but I didn't open it. And he said, oh, retirement plan. Yeah, right. But maybe a couple of weeks later, I was downtown and I was talking to Harold. And I looked, and they still had 3 bottles on the shelf. So I got a second one. So I have 2.
So there's still some on the shelf? You
said? No. This was several years ago. But sometimes we have these things come out, and they kind of linger. But this one
Sight
did not.
Unseen.
This one, we got 3 6-packs in, and they were gone within days.
Wow. Well, it's fantastic. It's definitely – the bourbon barrel is more pronounced.
And I can tell you, this is definitely a good barrel. When I was there a couple of years ago, we were out in the warehouse, and we pulled a couple of barrels that were 10 years old. One was a Heaven Hill barrel, and one was a Jim Beam barrel.
They send you up to Kilhoman?
Yeah. Well, I went. Nobody sends me anywhere. It's all out of my pocket. But I went, and James Wills, the son of the owner, took me over to the warehouse, and we found a couple of barrels that were 10 years old, and we took samples of them.
By the way, sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. You need to be posting those photos in HBS.
Yes, sir.
I think that, you know, Scotch – it's not a waning industry, but mm-hmm. It hasn't been – it's struggled up against bourbon at times.
Well, bourbon is the hot thing right now,
sure.
And it's taking some of the steam out of single malt scotch.
Sure.
But single malt scotch
but there's still a romance
plugging
there.
Away since the 1800s, so I think they're okay.
They're okay. They're definitely okay. But there's a romance there of the old country.
Yes.
You know, and as soon as you start telling me the story, I'm like, I want to see what it looks like. And I bet you've got photos on your phone.
I do.
You got to be posting this in HBS, man. This is a way to you know, there are plenty of Scots lovers in that group, and
yeah.
There's plenty that have been to Scotland, and I want to add it to my to-do list.
Okay.
You know, I've been to Scotland, but yeah. I want to go back, and I want to hit the other side of the
island. So when you went to Islay, did you fly in or did you take the ferry?
We flew in. Yeah, beautiful airport.
No,
I heard the ferry ride was like 3 hours or something.
It's a long ferry ride.
Yeah,
but
that's
nonsense. You need to take the ferry. Trust
so
me.
We were limited on time, and when we landed, it was already dark. And my, dark on Isla is dark. Is black.
Yes.
Yeah. So
well, my the bed and breakfast that I stay at every time I go is
we Airbnb
right
it, by
next
the way.
To the just, airport.
Yeah. Oh, the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's in the middle of nowhere.
We stay. We do.
I mean, Isla's in the middle of nowhere.
In general, it is. Yeah. They all the island's power comes from an underwater cable, and it goes out sometimes.
Yeah.
So, God.
I think they've got some wind turbines there now.
I hope so.
Because that's the big thing in Scotland is put them up. And
so you go to the warehouse, you pull out a couple of 10-year-old barrels.
Yeah, and I was actually a little disappointed in them. And what it really comes down to is that they were kind of one-dimensional. And when you do things like this, you tend to find various barrels and mix them together to get the dimension and the flavors that you're looking for.
Sure.
So when you do a single cask like this that comes out as good as this one did, that is an exceptional cask.
Sure. Yeah, you don't have to do anything to it.
Yeah, and Sam Filmus and Chris Udy went over and chose these casks. And
I hate to do this.
No, I understand.
I apologize.
You got other things to do today.
I got two meetings after this, but this is absolutely glorious. And you're right. You don't have to do anything to round it out. You don't have to add anything to it.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Just a pure product, which in that case is a real hidden gem. And it's the reason why I love this hobby is those you do all the homework, you do everything you can to create the product, and then you just hit the first domino and hope that all the dominoes line up. And then you go to the barrel and hope 10 years later that it's not garbage. Even if you have perfect distillate, but a bad barrel.
Well, and that's
You know, it's
these guys really go out of their way to have perfect distillate because everything is young. They don't have time to age off any
garbage,
any notes on either end of the cut.
Sure.
So their cut is a very narrow cut in the middle. They're very small stills, and you know, they just make a fantastic product. And you know, most of them are no age statement. They're not cheap. But
they're not absurd. I mean, bourbon right now is absurd.
But this is whiskey the way it was made in the 1800s, and it's like a throwback to be able to taste what your ancestors would have tasted.
Right. Well, and I've said this before. This will be the last thing I say before we go. Peat is generated over a very slow process and over a very long amount of time. So for every 12 inches of peat, I believe, is either 1 or 2,000 years, which means that it took thousands of years
to make this.
And you're getting it for $60.
Yeah.
I love bourbon. I love whiskey. But the fact that it took thousands of years and many dead small animals to create this, to generate the peat, to smoke it, is such a phenomenal, impactful real meaning to what goes into the glass. So with that being said, we are completely out of time.
All right.
I Gary.
Next time.
This was so much fun. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for coming
on. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Cheers, guys.